Welcome to the Wednesday edition of The Record here on KUOW Seattle. We're tweeting at KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I'm in this week for Bill Radke. A lot of news ahead. Wages between gender disparity between men and women at Seattle's city government. Seattle's sports identity. And we're going to talk about what it means to be a hermit. But first, this morning, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan announced that he would not run for re-election.
This is my 20th year in Congress. My kids weren't even born when I was first elected. Our oldest was 13 years old when I became Speaker. Now all three of our kids are teenagers. And one thing I've learned about teenagers is their idea of an ideal weekend is not necessarily to spend all of their time with their parents. What I realize is if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen.
Speaker Ryan wanting to spend more quality time with his family. He's just one of a growing number of retiring or resigning congressional members. Many of these folks are Republican. The 2018 midterm elections promised to shake up both the House and the Senate. Political advisors and pundits have been wondering whether or not a wave of new Democrats will enter the congressional halls next year. One ripple in that wave could take place in the 5th congressional district in Washington state. Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers has held that seat since 2005, but a new poll just out suggests a tightening race between McMorris Rogers and her opponent, Democrat Lisa Brown. One of the folks who took part in surveying for that new poll, Doug Nadvornik, is with us. He's a reporter and program director for Spokane Public Radio. Hi, Doug. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Marcy. Good to be here.
Congresswoman McMorris Rogers has represented the 5th for 13 years now. Can you really imagine the district flipping?
Yes, maybe. A lot of it, there are a lot of variables. For example, we found out in this study that about a half of the people who were polled didn't approve of Donald Trump's, his job performance, and her own job performance was roughly equal with the people who thought she does a good job with those who think she doesn't do a good job. So obviously she's got some hurdles here. But I guess I would submit that Lisa Brown is well enough known that somewhere down the line we're going to hear that she spends like a Seattle liberal and that her job performance rating as a legislator wasn't great either. So it's going to be interesting to hear what the rhetoric's going to be over the next 7 months.
Doug, when was the last time a Democrat held the 5th congressional district seat?
Tom Foley, 1994.
So it's been quite some time.
It's been quite some time, yeah.
Did you get a sense of rumbling for change?
Maybe, because McMorris Rogers is seen by many people as tied to the hip with Donald Trump. And for some people, that's a great thing. For other people, they don't think so because they're not Donald Trump fans. And so I think she, for some people, she's just not independent enough. And so she's tried to inch her way. For example, she was for a ban on bump stocks, whereas President Trump was initially for that. And so she's tried to inch her way in little ways, but the question is she far enough away from Trump that she's going to be seen as independent enough?
Kathy McMorris Rogers is the 4th ranking House Republican. Tom Foley, when he was in office, was equally high in status. What would the 5th congressional district lose if she was defeated?
Well, that's another good question, because a lot of people think she doesn't do what Tom Foley did in terms of routing a whole lot of taxpayer money to the 5th district. She might disagree. Republicans might disagree with that. So I'm not sure that a lot of people really understand what that seniority system's all about. Although with Speaker Ryan saying that he's not going to be around next year, she might inch up into the number 3 spot in the House. And so we may hear more comparisons to Tom Foley and the power that he had. Stuart Elway, the pollster, and I were talking about it, and I had mentioned to him that I thought this was the most compelling race for the 5th District since 1994. And he said, yeah, I worked on that. I pulled that one. And he looked at his numbers and he said, in September of 1994, He had George Nethercutt ahead, and he said nobody was believing me that he would win. But in April of that year, 24 years exactly, he said Tom Foley had 40% of the vote in my poll, and Nethercutt had 36. Well, we're at 44 for McMorris Rodgers and 38 for Lisa Brown, with 16% still uncommitted to that. So it's close enough that maybe that uncommitted number will lead to, you know, some sort of changing the way it's going to be.
Doug Nikvornik, you also talked about the issues that voters are concerned about. And one in particular is really making headlines right now. That is gun control. Did anything surprise you in what you heard?
So the one thing that surprised me was that there was a question regarding, would you support raising the minimum age to be able to buy a semi-automatic rifle from 18 to 21? And 62% of those said, yes, we would support that. And I guess that's surprising to me a little bit because of the conservative nature of the district and the gun ownership, the support of gun ownership. But I talked with one woman who said, I'm not for gun control, but she said, and I asked her, I said, are your views slanted at all by what has happened in terms of school shootings over the years? And she said, yes, and maybe it's better that we raise that age so that people are a little more mature when they're able to buy guns.
Doug Nikvornik, reporter and program director for Spokane Public Radio, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Marcy.
We're going to continue with following the district races as we head to the midterm elections, including the race for the 8th Congressional District. Congressman Dave Reichert not running for re-election there. It's The Record on KUOW. You may not realize yesterday was a holiday of sorts, Equal Pay Day, and it's supposed to mark the day when women's earnings finally catch up to what a man earned in the previous year. In other words, it takes more than 15 months for a woman to earn the same pay a man pulls down in 12 months. Equal Pay Day almost always lands in April, and unequal hiring practices are part of the reason why. Crosscut's David Croman reported on one surprising reason why the city of Seattle's wage gap has been so stubborn. He's in our studios to talk about it. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. Under former Mayor Ed Murray, Seattle touted itself as being 90% of the way toward pay equity. What do we really know now?
So they did this study in 2015. They hired this consultant to come on and sort of they determined, as you said, that women earned about 90 cents on the dollar, which compared to national, I mean, it still doesn't sound great, but compared to sort of national averages, that's better because nationally it's closer to 77 cents to the dollar. But in that study, they didn't actually include overtime pay. And so especially in departments, sort of transportation and utility departments that rely very, very heavily on overtime. When you factor that in, that actually kind of drags that pay equity. It makes it worse when you do actually include overtime.
To 78%, which is what the national standard is, or average, certainly not a standard.
Right. I mean, especially in the transportation and utilities departments, the pay equity goes from about 90 cents on the dollar all the way down to, like you said, 78 cents on the dollar.
Is that because men and women in those departments are being paid different base salaries?
Yeah, it sort of gets at why the pay equity gap is stubborn in some ways. It's not like sort of blatant discrimination in the way that some people might imagine. What's going on is that the positions in these departments that tend to earn the most overtime are just overwhelmingly held by men. So these are line workers and cable splicers and people who, when the power goes out or your new construction needs to be hooked up to the electricity grid, these are the people that go out there. And then there also happen to be the people that work the longest hours.
And are they hiring mostly men because that's who's trained to do those jobs? Or do you have to be 6 foot tall and really strong to do this sort of thing?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that kind of gets at the crux of this, which is why have we decided that some jobs are sort of, quote, men's jobs, and why are some jobs, quote, women's jobs? For whatever reason, a long time ago, that these particular jobs just sort of ended up being men's jobs. And the sort of end result of that is men in these departments are able to earn on average an extra $12,000 a year on their salary in overtime, whereas women are only able to earn an extra about $2,000.
So you write about these two departments in particular. Is this sort of wage gap common across the board? Are we really talking about sort of hands-on professions?
Yeah, I think it's mostly the kind of hands-on professions. I didn't look at the data for police and fire departments, but I imagine it would look sort of similar because that those are also departments that rely very heavily on overtime. But you know, just the fact that I focused on three departments shouldn't sort of undermine the significance of it, because those three departments make up 54% of the city's entire budget. So it's $3 billion budget. So it's not like this is a small corner of the city. It's a very large part of the total budget that is then therefore sort of throwing the entire pay equity question out of whack.
We hear the same sort of thing in Seattle's private sector, where the tech industry is mm-hmm. heavily skewed towards male employees as mm-hmm. well. I'm curious if Seattle's sort of lightning pace of growth has affected this at all.
Yeah, I think absolutely it has, sort of in an indirect way, in that these departments, they are really struggling to keep up with growth. So this is transportation, city light, public utilities. These are the departments that are sort of on the front lines of dealing with this growth. But some of their jobs tend to be seasonal. So some parts of the year are busier than others. So they don't want to hire hundreds of new people to just work really hard for a few extra months. So what ends up happening is in these months, they just use the employees that they have and end up using them for a ton of overtime, which, you know, in the long run ends up being sort of more cost effective for these departments. But when they're using so much overtime, which between these three departments is about $43 million, and then literally 92% of that overtime is going to men, all of a sudden you've got sort of a problem on your hands that I don't think city officials realized that they had.
No, and it sounds like a systemic situation that they're really going to have to rethink.
Mm-hmm.
My guest is David Croman of Crosscut, and we're talking about gender pay disparities in the city of Seattle. Mayor Durkan came into office just a few months ago, promising that she was going to improve gender equity, she was going to eliminate harassment in the workforce. Is she addressing this issue as well?
It's early, and this is a very big and complex problem, because I think sort of generally a lot of the pay equity questions aren't necessarily blatant discrimination like maybe you saw in the Mad Men days. Mm. A lot of this has to do with these sort of systemic questions about who are getting these jobs, and why are men being hired for more leadership positions, which tend to pay better, or why are men holding, in this case, these field worker jobs? So it's a really complex problem, and it's not so much an issue of just firing the right people or whatever who are making these decisions. To solve the problem, she would really have to go really far upstream, apprenticeship programs and things like that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because you have to train people to do this work, which means that you have to take five steps back from just hiring this pool of folks in the summer, where you're going to shut down lanes of traffic to fix whatever you're going to fix.
Right, exactly.
What concrete changes besides apprenticeship programs do you think the city could do to correct this?
Well, I think for the city, that is sort of a big step right now, is focusing on apprenticeship programs. But, I don't know how successful those have been. I haven't seen any sort of data on how often those actually lead to more women, or often more people of color, getting these jobs that are dominated by white men. So I think right now the strategy is sort of focusing on these programs, more outreach. But it would be a lie to say that this isn't a really complicated problem.
For a city that has made a stated goal, gender and race equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You clearly have to change something if you don't have that equity.
Yeah, exactly. And, I keep coming back to this, but I think sometimes when people hear wage equity gap, they want to sort of glom on to this discrimination or this intentionality to it. They imagine that there is some sort of person sitting atop who's saying I'm going to pay this man more than this woman to do the same job. In fact, when the city did its study, they found that men and women who held the same job were pretty much paid the same. But the fact that it might not be the fault of one particular person doesn't mean that this is not still an issue. I mean, it's right there. So it's a diffuse and complex problem.
Right there in the data. David Croman is city reporter for Crosscut. He reported on the larger than expected city gender wage gap in Seattle. We're tweeting out a link to his story right now at KUOW. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Record from KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman, and this week for Bill Radke. Okay, sports fans, it's time for you. What's happening in this city? The Legion of Boom is doomed. Ichiro is back in the dugout with Edgar. Hockey's coming here, right? I think we're getting a hockey team. And oh yeah, rugby. Seattle's now a rugby town. All of that begging the question, what kind of sports town are we? What does it mean? Fresh-faced newbies dream of the Stanley Cup, and I don't know what they give rugby champions when they win rugby, but maybe we'll have one of those. Or are we a town whose football and baseball teams did not make it to the playoffs last year, and we haven't managed to replace that men's basketball team that we lost to Oklahoma City? Here to hash out our sports identity, Kate Prusser, who is managing editor at Lookout Landing. She covers Seattle Mariners. Nice to meet you.
Hi, so nice to be here.
It is great. Michael Sean Dugar, Seahawks reporter at SeattlePI.com, is back with us. It's a pleasure to see you again. And Jeff Baker, the sports enterprise reporter at the Seattle Times, is here as well. Thanks for coming in. Well, it's spring, so that means a sport is happening, at least one professional sport. The Mariners, them are one game over 500, sounding pretty good. Despite critics, King Felix dealt a win last night, and Area 51 has returned to Safeco. Ichiro, I think, still back in left field. So, Kate, October, here we come?
It's rough. It's a rough outlook in an AL West that is stacking up to be maybe one of the best divisions in baseball, which is unfortunate because the team is off to a pretty good start. I think the chemistry is really clicking. Dee Gordon has been. It's so funny to me that he wasn't talked about that much as an off-season pickup. Everyone talked about the quiet season that the off-season that the Mariners had because they didn't acquire starting pitching, which is what everyone. I mean, it was a need so glaring it could be seen from space, according to most pundits and writers, and even at the site, we talked a lot about. Who are they going to get? What are they going to do? And the answer is they beefed up the bullpen and they invested some money in getting Dee Gordon in a trade. And he has been, I think, maybe the biggest difference maker in getting the season off to a strong start.
Well, every year I feel like Jeff and Michael Sean, that we say, okay, this is it. Yay. Everything's going great. And then in June, we say, okay, that's the end. And I still believe the indelible image that we have of Mariners baseball is Ken Griffey Jr. grinning under that pileup of his teammates. And that was his first go round as a Mariner. So that's, you know, like almost 20 years ago, I think. So, you know, what is it about we love this team? Are we like those Chicago Cubs fans who like to like revel in being the underdogs?
It was 23 years ago.
Oh, ouch.
If you want to get precise about it, 1995. And yeah, a lot of Mariners fans do point out that the team does like to show highlight clips of that 95 season
over and over
again. Yeah. And part of the reason is there hasn't been that many highlights since that time. There's been a few. I think with baseball, and I covered it for 16 years, and I got sucked in at times covering two teams, the Blue Jays and the Mariners, over the years. I got pulled into believing in teams too early. And the one thing I learned is that you really can't tell what's going to happen in baseball until about June or July, until you see things really start to shake down, until you see whether or not they're going to need to make trades at midseason, and whether or not with this team, what's especially, and Kate alluded to it, the starting pitching is going to be worth keeping an eye on, especially over the first couple of months, because it's been inconsistent up to this point. We've seen Felix Hernandez look good. We've seen Felix Hernandez look great for five innings. We've seen him look really bad for a few innings. And the rest of the rotation's kind of followed suit that way. You don't know what you're going to get from day to day. Right now, they're on the positive side of the ledger. So it's a decent start. It could be 0-9, and then we'd all be complaining. So this is a lot better.
Well, do we have something about bringing back our old, aged heroes? Ichiro's how old at this point? I mean, I'm delighted that he's here, but, man, he's old.
Yeah, baseball's good at that. Baseball's good at honoring its past. Well,
is that a good thing?
Some of it. I don't want to make that blanket statement and not mention a few things. But baseball is for the most part, it's like pretty good at that. It'll celebrate like the old. It does it better than like the NFL, where you'll see like a guy gets old, it's like you're out of here.
Yeah, we did see that. Yeah,
the thing with like Kobe's retirement year was kind of rare. Like you really don't see baseball or other sports doing it. So I do like that about baseball. And with fans, I do like the drop off from opening day to the rest of the week. It's amazing how crazy a crowd can be.
There were a lot of people,
opening day,
yeah, anywhere though.
Everywhere, not just here. Like, but yeah, Seattle too. But it's like, it's crazy how many people can come out for opening day, and then like two games later, it's just crickets, right? Like it's you don't get that in those other sports either, too. Like even if your team's bad, right? In football, you're there in September, you're there, but you're gone. You're still there in November, even if you guys are out of the playoffs.
Isn't that because you paid a fortune for those football tickets, and some of the baseball seats are a little bit cheaper?
Well, also, I mean, football is a little bit better to watch, in my biased opinion. But the drop off is fascinating. You're right. But then, yeah, by June, if your team's not, you know, in contention, you're not caring.
I think you made a good point earlier, Marcy. You said, it seems that we're a town that falls in love with some of these big name players, and I find that pretty accurate. I've worked now in three different cities in two countries. And I can tell you, Seattle definitely loves its name players more than a lot of the cities I've been in. And, at times that's a very good thing. They can be very loyal to certain players. Times not such a good thing. I think that's what's causing a lot of the consternation right now about what the Seahawks are doing, because they're saying goodbye to a lot of named players. And we're just not used to that as a sports town in Seattle. We're used to keeping guys around maybe, a little too long. At times, Griffey's second go-around would be a prime example of that.
I hope that's not the case for Ichiro. I have a soft spot in my heart. Jeff Baker, Michael Sean Dugar, Kate Prusser are here. And Michael Sean, since you're the football guy here, we just heard essentially the Legion of Boom that we loved has departed. And a lot of folks, the fair-weather fans among us, I'm not counting you, but I'm counting myself, we fell in love with the Seahawks because of the Super Bowl win and because of that sort of heady run. I mean, is the 12th man the next to go?
Well, I would hope not, because that means the money's gone.
Ah.
And I like having a place to stay myself, so I would like the money to keep coming in for everyone, so I can, I'm selfish in that regard.
Did those big names leave because of money, or are the Seahawks really looking to reinvent?
Well, it's both, right? Like I was just saying, like baseball's really good at honoring the old and like, keeping the nostalgia there. Football, you're 30, get out. Like basically, that you see that everyone that you kind of see fading away. Richard Sherman, I think he just turned 30 last couple weeks ago. Michael Bennett's over 30. I think Cam's either 30 or about to be 30. Like that. So once you get there, everyone just talks about you like you're 75 and you're not worth anything anymore in football.
Well, or you might be on your way to some sort of traumatic brain injury.
If you don't have like 10 of them already, okay. Right, depending on your position.
I think that people also sort of fell in love with that good, clean image of Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll not doing what Tom Brady and Bill Belichick do to win games. But maybe should the Seahawks be more like Belichick-ish?
Well, I mean, every team should want to win, right? Like, do whatever, like, it's a copycat league, right? So if they're doing this to win, you should try it. But I think what happened was, I kind of think of it like you have, like, a boy band or someone you grew up with, and then they break up and you're all sad and you want to recapture the love. But then they add these new people and it's just not the same. Because what you really fell in love with was the people, but you also fell in love with the moment.
Yeah.
Too. So, like, I caution the Seahawks fans. Like, there's going to be good players, right? Seahawks are going to have good players because Pete and John know what they're doing. But to recapture the moment with the Legion of Boom is going to be hard because you fell in love with Richard and Earl and Cam and Russell and everybody because you saw them grow. But like it's you also fell in love with the moment too because there was like this ascension with like the 12s and the city and them all together. Like that won't be recaptured. Doesn't mean the team won't be good, but I don't think that will be recaptured.
Is this you, Jeff? You've worked other places. Is this a unique Seattle response to teams, or is every city this attached to a sports team?
I think it comes in degrees. I mean, Seattle's still a relatively young sports city in terms of, I mean, you mentioned the Chicago Cubs earlier. I mean, they didn't win a World Series for a century. There's a huge difference between what's going on in that city, and which has had that kind of exposure to sports for a long period of time, versus what's going on here. And we are still relatively young. We're going through a bit of a transition phase right now because we're going to have new teams coming on board. We're going to go from being a city that wasn't really on the map to being one that's going to have five professional teams any minute now. So I mean, you know, it's a bit all over the map as far as that goes. I think the fans here did fall in love with the Seahawks predominantly because they won a championship, and we don't do that very often in Seattle. So there was a lot to like.
Well,
about that team.
I find it really intriguing that this professional hockey team that's not here yet already sold 33,000 season tickets for the 2020 inaugural season and is getting an old boss, Seattle Hockey Partners, named former Seahawks CEO Todd Lewecki as the new president of, I don't know what is
he's going to be the new president and CEO of the hockey group, the hockey team, which is yet to be announced. It's going to be announced in June.
Okay, so will he do a good job for hockey, Michael Sean, like he did for football?
Well, I think Jeff is the resident hockey expert.
Okay, are you the hockey man?
I guess by default. I was born in Canada, okay. So that makes me 90% of the hockey
You're
guy.
Genetically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, Todd Lewecki, you know, he spent years running the Tampa Bay Lightning. He transformed that franchise from what was really a doormat franchise in the NHL. They did win a Stanley Cup prior to that, but they really weren't connecting with the fans. And by the time he left, they had connected with the fans there to the point where they were selling out every game. They have one of the best in-game experiences in the NHL. Once you get inside the arena, there's a lot he can do in the sport of hockey that was done here with the 12s, with the Seahawks fans in football.
And there's this other team, and Kate Prusser, you had to ask about it before we went on the air. The Seattle Seawolves are making their debut Sunday, the 22nd of April, in Tukwila. That's a rugby team. Did you even know that was happening?
No.
Okay.
Honestly, I'm not entirely sure what rugby is. Is it like cricket? Are there bats?
No, it's kind of like football. Without as much carnage, there is, but it's just like, you know.
But everyone, they don't wear any helmets or pads.
So like they got headgear. I think.
Do they have the leather helmets? Like
I don't
the
know.
Old-timey football.
Okay,
players?
it's not like that.
I'm just telling you.
No, they do not. They do not wear helmets.
Right, they wear shorts.
Yeah, no helmets. I do know that.
You can Google it and you see all those guys from New Zealand doing those Haka war chants. That would be fun if they did that here.
I'll have to ask them if they're going to do that. It's actually a new professional rugby league that has just started up.
A new league?
Yeah, an entirely new league. It's a nine-team league, eight or nine teams. I'm trying to remember. They've got a ninth team, I think, coming in next year from New York. But right now they're going to start off, I believe it's an eight-team league. And I should know this already, but I don't. They've actually got a few television deals, including here locally. And so that's a good start for the league. They've apparently sold out their season tickets and... I believe they've sold out a couple of their early games. They're going to play at Starfire in Tukwila. And so that should be interesting to go and see. And if you ask them, they'll tell you rugby is completely different from football. I don't know. I'll have to go see.
I guess we'll have to go see. I can't not mention soccer because the Sounders have a massive following, loyal fans. They have, I guess, it seems to me that there's a lot of different kind of cups in soccer. So it's not like you win the World Series. It's like you can win any number of things, and they seem to have won some of those things. So that's good?
Yeah, it's very good. The MLS Cup is kind of like the World Series, and they won that in 2016, and they lost that this past December. But then they have other cups, the U.S. Open Cup, which is the biggest open championship in the States, and then they just played in the Champions League because they won that MLS Cup 2 years ago. So now they get to play against other champions from other countries. They made it to the quarterfinals of that, and then they lost down in Mexico.
So, Michael Sean Dugar, are we now a soccer city and not a football city?
Not yet. The Sounders crowd is kind of crazy. I think I actually went to my first Sounders game last year.
Did you sit down at all?
A little bit. a little bit.
Because I hear most people just stand up.
Oh no, it was great. Well, I don't have the energy for all that all the time. Yeah, I'm only 25. I got old body because of sports. That's why I like to mention the danger of sports. Man, I limped in here, man. I'm probably the youngest person in the room, but I think we'll still be a football town as long as the biggest name in sports is the quarterback here in town.
Kate Brewster, are we a baseball town?
I hope that under the new ownership, under the new regime, under DePoto, we can recapture the baseball glory of years past. I really like the direction that they're trending in. I think that they've done some things that haven't worked. They brought in a bunch of flyball pitchers last year at the same time the flyball revolution was happening.
I don't even know what that is. Does that mean
how
making
much
somebody
the ball gets hit in the air?
I see. I deduced that, but I didn't. So that was a bad thing to do.
It was an ill-timed experiment. Okay. They have backed off of that. They have gone to more ground ball pitchers. They're not afraid to say what doesn't work. So,
you know, one thing we haven't talked about is that we do have a multi-award-winning team here, and that's a women's basketball team, Seattle Storm. What role, if any, do the two professional women's sports teams play, the Reign and the Storm?
Well, I think they play an important role in the city, not just as role models for female fans, but just, you know, for fans definitely for basketball, as far as the Storm goes, because they're the only professional basketball team in town. And then, you know, women's soccer is you know, a very popular sport for kids growing up. And, you know, it's great to be able to have role models on the women's side of the game, which is, you know, it's not a completely different game from the men, but our women are in the United States are some of the best soccer players in the entire world, unlike the men's team, which is still getting there. So, I mean, I think it's an important role to play for secondary sports fans as well, who don't necessarily want to spend thousands of dollars on season tickets. It's a lot easier to go see those games.
They're also more, they win more than the men's team. So if they perform better, why do we still prefer to pay money to watch the men lose?
Well, I'll take that one since I've got a big mouth. I think that I think that in general, there's a perception that the men's players that are out there are playing the sport at the highest possible level in the world. There are people that will tell you if you put a men's team against a women's team, the men's team will win every time. And I think that it's that kind of mindset that permeates it. And it's also the hype, the media hype that surrounds it, the television contracts. I mean, you can't go anywhere without seeing you know, an NFL football game, and you know that this is the big spectacle. This is the big world-class sport. You know, it's not quite like going to see a Seattle Reign game at Memorial Stadium, where, you know, you'll have 5,000 people in the stands. A little bit different.
I mean, if I could just interject briefly, I think you saw that dichotomy in the NCAA tournament this year. The women's tournament was so much more interesting than the men's tournament. The games were much closer. You had the big upset with Notre Dame knocking off UConn. I mean, it was thrilling. And yet, March Madness, all of that is filtered through the men's basketball. So, unfortunately, I think it was Kobe Bryant who tweeted out that, well, if you say that you like basketball, but you only watch men's basketball, you don't like basketball, you like entertainment. You like dunks, you like the showiness, you know, you like the trappings of the sport and maybe not the fundamentals of the sport.
I got to give Michael Shawn the last question because it's something not so much about playing the game, but about the NFL in general and the politics around the league and Seattle being sort of a predominantly liberal town. We have embraced demonstrations of political solidarity by ex-Seahawks like Michael Bennett. What role do you think that this team plays for us in when we think beyond the sport itself?
I think in terms of the political stuff, like there is a perception, like with Paul Allen and just the ownership, John and Pete, that like it's a little bit more free here. Like even last year, Seattle was the only team to give Colin Kaepernick even a job interview, All right, like that's significant. They didn't give him a job, which is a bit more significant. But like Seattle does have that perception, like this kind of area does too. Just like it's, I guess liberal is the word I'll use kind of loosely, and that's important because I mean you can if you don't have that perception, I mean people still go to your games, right? People still go to Ravens games and they'll still go to Houston Texans games. They probably shouldn't, but they will. But that's important though. Like people want to believe that you can like your owner's not just like. I don't know, racist. Like you want to feel like that, like because you can go talk to a Texans fan right now and be like, "Dude, your owner sucks," and they have no retort, right? Like that's really important in today, right now, with everything that's going. Like you don't want your owner aligned with the president right now, which is a weird statement to say, but it's accurate.
So we want our teams to win, but we also want our teams somehow to reflect us in a way. So having strong women's teams, having teams with progressive values. And having teams that bring back old guys like Ichiro, who can still jump and stop a home run. So, you know, he's a symbol for all of us gray hairs. I'd like to thank our panelists, Kate Prusser, who's managing editor at Lookout Landing, covering the Mariners, Michael Sean Dugar, Seahawks reporter at SeattlePI.com, and Jeff Baker, multi-sports watcher. He's the sports enterprise reporter at the Seattle Times. Thanks, all of you, for coming in today.
Thanks.
This is The Record. You're with The Record here on KUOW Seattle. We're tweeting at KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman in this week for Bill Radke. Missile strikes on Syria, FBI investigations, your personal data is sold and used to sway elections, threats of nuclear war. Do news headlines ever make you want to just flee, throw away your smartphone and start a new life in the woods alone? In 1986, a young man in Maine walked away from everything. Christopher Knight set up a small camp in the deep Maine woods, and eventually people nearby began to call him the North Pond Hermit. Michael Finkel chronicled this man's story in his book, The Stranger in the Woods, out in paperback now. Welcome to The Record.
Thank you.
So Christopher Knight, this North Pond Hermit, spent 27 years living in a secluded encampment. He didn't speak to a single person in those nearly 30 years. How did he subsist there?
Yeah, he didn't make a phone call, spend any money, see the internet, drive in a car, use an indoor toilet. He was, in a word, rugged. In a second word, highly intelligent and able to solve major problems. I'm an outdoorsman myself, spent most of my time in Montana, where I spend a lot of time outdoors, and his ability to set up a tent, to figure out things, how to even get water when it's below freezing, how to survive without lighting a fire. He was afraid that smoke would give his encampment away, and lived through these winters without lighting a fire. And without getting into too much detail, just was ingenious at figuring out how to survive without making a fatal mistake, which is hard to imagine. You remember that story, Into the Wild, with Chris McCandless, another Chris. And Chris McCandless died after 4 months in the Alaska wild, and Christopher Knight, after 27 years, came out strong as an ox.
Well, he was very ingenious in terms of setting up his encampment and trying to maintain a body temperature in the Maine winters. But he also did something to subsist that a lot of people... It wasn't like he was living off of berries and squirrel meat. He was a burglar.
Yes, Chris Knight was a thief. And as he told me, to tell everybody else, I am not to romanticize him, although I do speak warmly about him from time to time. Yeah, I asked him, why didn't you hunt and fish? And he grew up in central Maine and is a skilled fisherman and a hunter. Very frequently, Chris Knight, during our interviews, compared himself with animals. And he usually meant that as a compliment. He liked to get as fat as possible and gather as much food as possible before the long winter, just like all the animals in the forest. And in Montana, where I live, there's always a couple times a year where all the garbage cans in the neighborhood are overturned by bears that have just come out of hibernation. Well, why don't those bears get berries that week? What are they doing with the garbage can? And the answer is that it is way more efficient
energy efficient. To do that, Chris Knight, living alone in the woods, needed to be as efficient as possible. Very difficult to hunt and fish in a cold climate. Much easier to pick locks and take things from pantries. If animals had opposable thumbs, I bet they'd be picking locks and taking food from our houses.
Being a thief was eventually his downfall.
Chris Knight not only spent 27 years completely alone, and he spoke a total of one syllable one time. He said hi to a passing hiker in 27 years, but that wasn't even enough for him. His intention, as hard as this is to imagine, and by the way, this story is true, completely true, he planned to spend his entire life secluded from the rest of humanity and was arrested by an extremely energetic and motivated, obsessed game warden who solved the case.
Well, the game warden started tracking him because people nearby, I mean, he wasn't that far, Christopher Knight, from where people lived. People nearby started noticing stuff gone missing.
Yeah, there's so many elements of the story. It's like catnip for a journalist. There's like, you know, the adventure tale, the survival, the solitude. Yeah, and the true crime aspect is confounding. It was second homes, little encampments around these lakes in central Maine that were missing small things, hamburger meat, Stephen King novels, your batteries, but no doors are kicked in, no windows are broken, your computer's there, your money's there, your jewelry. It sort of like fell in the cracks of between being unsettling but not really a crime. And it didn't go on for 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. It went on for more than a quarter century, so long that people had no idea. Was it a man? Was it a woman? A gang of people? Somebody disgruntled? They didn't know, but they just gave this mystery a name. And they called it the North Pond Hermits. And it was, I mean, there were kids who grew up with North Pond Hermit stories who had kids of their own. At least three college papers were written about it. And it was like there was like the Loch Ness Monster, the Himalayan Yeti, and the North Pond Hermit. It was that much of a legend.
We're talking about the book, The Stranger in the Woods, about the North Pond Hermit with Michael Finkel, who wrote this book. You live in Montana, as you said earlier. This happened in Maine. How did you hear about Christopher Knight?
I read a small news report from the Kennebec County Journal in central Maine, the online edition, and it sort of tweaked all of the obsessive and curious parts of my journalistic makeup. I love to spend time outside, and I love to read books. And this is a guy who basically spent his whole life outside reading thousands of books, basically the world champion of two of my favorite things to do. And I think speaking with hermits is a primal curiosity. Like, we want to know, oh, guru, what do you have to say about the rest of us? What did you learn? Why did you leave? Are you, as you mentioned before, are you crazy? Are you mentally insane? What is this story even true? And, you know, I had hundreds of questions and eventually wrote him a letter. We started our relationship. By the way, anybody out there who wants to communicate with someone who hasn't spoken in 27 years, I suggest starting with a letter. And that was really, by luck or by good guess, it was a great way to initiate a correspondence with a very shy individual by handwritten, old-fashioned epistolary interview style.
How long was it before you finally went to Maine to meet him in person?
Well, you know, despite the fact that I am not to romanticize Chris Knight the Hermit, you can imagine that someone who just spent 27 years in complete autonomy and freedom in the woods, who's now locked in a cage with another person he was arrested for stealing food and put in jail, would be suffering. And after a season's worth of sending letters, he said that he felt that he was losing his sanity more after a couple of months in jail than he ever did after nearly 30 years in the woods, and was too upset to even continue writing. And I took a chance and I went to Maine from Montana. I checked in at the visiting booth at the jail and he agreed to see me. He had, I think, rejected the overtures of something like 500 other journalists. So I'm forever grateful to Chris Knight for choosing me to share, to tell a story. And we did meet in the jail about 9 times for an hour each.
The encounters don't sound as if they were very easy. This was, while you may find him sympathetic, he seemed to me to be a very difficult man to get the story out of.
Yeah, I think I have masochistic tendencies. Chris Knight was not my friend. He's a truly a private individual, possibly the most private individual that has ever lived that I could find. And of course, he was very difficult to speak with. And I don't know, respected that? Or, you know, if you're going to talk to someone who has truly lived their life as an utter outlier, apart from all society for all this time, I mean, he left the woods before there were even cell phones, let alone internet, and you know, didn't come back until after. Like, I expected it to be challenging, and I sort of was, instead of being frustrated by the lack of communication, was very appreciative for what things Chris did speak to me about. And he also had a very beautiful way of using the English language. It was almost like he invented his own dialect. I'm probably not going to be able to mimic it too well here on the radio, but in the book I tried to capture the way he spoke really touched me.
One of the things I wondered in reading about this man is whether it was 27 years alone in the woods that made him the way he was when you finally spoke with him, or for, he was like that, and that's why he went to spend 27 years in the woods. In other words, does 27 years apart from human interaction transform you totally, or do you have to be of that bent to seek that out?
You know, I can imagine people listening to this conversation wondering, oh, I wonder what mental illness he has. Is he autistic, or they don't have the diagnosis Asperger's anymore, but it, you know, in that category. And the truth is, he was examined by the state psychologist in Maine, and several other experts weighed in on his case, and there really is no label you can put on Chris Knight. He's such an outlier. For example, many autism experts said his ability to plan so many months in advance for winter seemed antithetical to almost any other person they'd met on the spectrum. One psychologist offered 15 possible diagnoses and then sort of threw his hands up and said, I diagnose him as a hermit. And I think sort of one of the deeper themes of the book and thinking about Chris Knight is what do we do with someone who really doesn't fit into society? If you're like Chris Knight ever even had a penknife with him, he's not a real evil, violent criminal. We know what to do with evil and violent criminals. We have a prison system for you. If you are truly mentally insane, well, then we do have doctors and hospitals for you. But what if you just don't fit into the rest of the world? We don't really have a place for you. What do we do with it? And it's one of the questions that the book asks.
Other cultures do have a place for you. American culture might not be a culture, but you write about many other traditions around the world where it's actually a great thing. It's the highest thing that you could do is to go seek enlightenment or spiritual fulfillment or what have you alone.
Right. I mean, we're generally speaking, humans are a social species. We loved, I mean, just watch what anybody has, 30 free seconds of time. What do? We meditate? No, we fish our phones out and communicate further. But throughout history, in all cultures, at all times, there have been those people who have wanted to remove themselves from society, whether it's for religious or artistic or self-fulfillment reasons. And Chris Knight fits into this grand tradition. It goes back to the beginning of time. I mean, Jesus himself spent 40 days completely alone in the Judean desert for establishing a religion that has, what, more than a billion followers today.
Have you ever had hermit-like impulses?
Yes. I have three little kids at home and a wife and a busy job, and so my house is noisy. It seems 24/7. Even before I encountered Chris Knight, and maybe one of the reasons why it fired up my curiosity, I was very interested in people that spent time alone and tried it myself. I went to a 10-day silent meditation retreat in India, and I was terrible at it. It was one of the most difficult things I have ever done. And this is, you know, all I had to do was just sit there and do nothing, and it is the most difficult thing. So I was a failure as a hermit, but I gave it a try, and I don't know, we were afraid to spend time alone. The only person we're ever really going to know in the whole world is ourselves, and we're afraid to do it. And I include myself in that category. And so my curiosity and fascination of people who were able to go to the bottom of that, like, internal well. I think humans have been curious forever, and I am equally curious.
Towards the end of Chris Knight's stay in jail, he became, or at least expressed to you, some suicidal thoughts. He was very unhappy. Is he still alive?
Yeah, so the book itself and the story of Chris Knight, you know, has what would cause someone to go into the woods? Why would you stay? What happened to you? What did you feel for being alone? And then one of the other questions I had is what happens with someone who has lived all by themselves for the heart of their life? Imagine between the ages of 20 and 47. Before that, you're an adolescent. After that, you're practically a middle-aged person. What happens to a person that has been pulled out of that involuntarily and stuck back in our fast-paced 24/7 ridiculously busy society. And probably not surprising, Chris Knight did not return to society easily. He felt overwhelmed. Of course, I feel overwhelmed, and I consider myself an active member of this society. And I think there's two or three times a day where I can't believe how too muchness is upon me. And there was he spent only 7 months in jail, by the way, Chris Knight. And upon his release, he was very upset, and we had a very heartbreaking conversation once he was released from jail. It seemed like he would be more free, but in a weird way, jail has its structure and rigidity, and suddenly being plunked into society was almost less freeing to someone like Chris Knight, and expressed ideas that he might kill himself. And I was obviously extremely worried, and I'm happy to report that he has not followed through on that, and we are no longer in contact. Chris Knight is a true hermit. He did not want to be my friend. But to the best of my knowledge, he is still living in central Maine, has not returned to the woods, and he is a true survivor, has carved out a life for himself that at least is acceptable.
Michael Finkel is the author of The Stranger in the Woods. He's going to be speaking at REI in Seattle tonight at 6:30. Thanks so much for coming by today.
Thanks for having me on.
And that wraps up The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajwa Jima Brempong, and Casey Martin. Bree Ripley tweeting tomorrow, an interview with the outgoing president of Planned Parenthood, Cecile Richards. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. Have a good afternoon.